Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com. Hello, welcome to the podcast. I'm Sarah Dowdy, and I'm very happy to be here with a very special guest today.
Hi, everybody.
It's Candace. She's back.
Vintage Stuff You Missed in History Class podcasting.
Well, and Candace, we always get emails asking where you've gone or where you are. And I usually just say, she's sitting right behind me in the cube. But, I mean, you could probably elaborate a little more than that.
Well, I have switched my focus from history to weddings, which is actually a lot of fun. I've been working on the TLC Weddings website, and if you haven't visited yet, you really should. Even if you're not planning a wedding yourself, you can get some fun information on modern trends and classic trends. Fashion tips, flower tips, all of that. And one more fun piece of vintage Stuff You Missed in History Class news that pertains to weddings. One of your other favorite hosts from the days of yore, Jane McGrath, just recently got engaged. Yeah. So she'll be flooding that website too.
Congratulations, Jane. And I'm very excited to record this episode with you, Candace. And so we actually picked a theme that was sort of fitting with Candace's new role at HowStuffWorks and TLC, and that is, of course, weddings.
And when we pick these 5 weddings, I told Sarah we should pick some of our favorite weddings in history, and all but one turned out to have rather sad endings. So we're going to start with the happiest, and when we're done, go ahead and get out your vintage lace hankies, because it all goes downhill from here.
Very lovely weddings, but some kind of sad marriages.
That's right.
We picked tragedies, I guess. But yeah, this first one is good. And it's probably one of the best known historical weddings, I'd say, just because of how many wedding trends it ultimately established.
Right. We'll say that the marriage of Victoria and Albert on February 10th, 1840 set some precedents for modern brides. And most of you probably know that the reason brides today wear white is because Victoria started that tradition.
She started so many trends.
She did.
I think using ether during childbirth, that's a cool Victoria trend.
Thanks for that, Victoria. So here's a little history on Victoria. She became queen in 1837, and she was just 18 years old. And her wedding was the first one since 1554 when a throned queen took a husband. And we mentioned that she set the tone for modern weddings by wearing white, but she also chose when to wed and whom.
Yeah, they were a love match, which was something quite surprising for royalty in general at the time, but especially a queen choosing who she's going to marry.
And the person she chose was Albert, who was her German cousin, the prince consort. They met in 1836 and were engaged just 3 years later. And while I personally hate snakes and demanded a big honking diamond, Victoria asked, or received rather, a snake ring with diamond eyes.
Which seems so punk for Victoria.
I know.
It's just not in keeping at all with the woman I imagine her, but I guess snakes are more of a trend back then?
It was a symbol, actually. The snake's coil symbolized the bonds of eternal love, just like we think of the circle of a wedding band.
Okay, so
symbolizing
kind of
eternity.
Kind of a Cleopatra style, I guess.
Yeah,
Victoria.
There you go.
But this is an old superstition, I guess, that a rainy wedding day is actually good luck. And maybe in this case it proved true because they had a rainy wedding day, but ultimately a very happy marriage together.
They did. It was an early wedding. It was in the middle of the day, and it was followed by a breakfast celebration. It took place at St. James's Palace, and they had a very grand procession from Buckingham Palace to St. James's, and the procession included her 12 bridesmaids. And I mentioned she had a white gown, which was unusual for the time, because before her, any time a royal got married, she would wear a very heavy brocade gown and lots of jewels, an ermine cloak, and she wanted something lighter and more feminine. But the one aristocratic element that she did demand was handmade lace.
Yeah, didn't it take about 200 people to make all of the lace?
It did. And by this time in the Victorian era, a lot of fabric making was automated or machine made, but
so
she
that
wanted
was a real
it handmade.
Luxury.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it was a happy day and an even happier wedding night. We have a little glimpse from Victoria's journal, and she had this to say about it. The wedding night was all moonlight and roses and a fair wind and the pleasures of sex.
So sounds like a good time for
a nice,
this
satisfied
cousin
queen.
Couple. But I mean, they go on to have a very successful marriage and a successful reign. It's actually debt free, which is kind
huge.
Of amazing considering how much a queen would normally spend.
Right. But that just goes to demonstrate one of the concepts that we associate with Victorianism, and that's thrift, for instance.
Frugality, exactly.
Right. And Gillian Gill, who's a biographer who wrote We Two about Victoria and Albert, she says that their relationship illustrates so many different Victorian concepts, and these are just a few. You've got faith and thrift, which we've mentioned, mm-hmm. discipline, patriotism, responsibility, and stability. They really were a model for the whole country.
They also have a very fruitful marriage. They have 9 kids. And they also helped popularize that family portrait of, you know, the doting mother and the dutiful father and all of their babies and children surrounding them.
Which is needless to say that when Albert died in 1861, Victoria was just crushed. Those had been some of the happiest years of her life, and without him, she became very depressed and wore black until her death in 1901 when she died from natural causes.
Our next wedding and marriage on this list is going to be equally grand, but a lot more tragic than the last. It's also a royal wedding, though. It's Louis XIV and Maria Theresa of Spain. So we're going to give a little background on this just because the circumstances of the couple's birth are really interesting, I think. So Louis XIV was a surprise. The French were really hoping for an heir, but his mother was 36, almost 37 years old, and she hadn't given birth to a living child yet. Then all of a sudden, out comes Louis XIV, this healthy baby boy. And only 5 days later, his mother Anne's brother, Philip IV, who is the king of Spain, has a daughter. And Anne is immediately thinking, oh, well, perfect.
As most modern mothers would, marry your cousin.
This little niece of mine can someday be the wife of my son. This was especially an especially tantalizing match because Maria Theresa had a claim to the Spanish throne at one point, so it would be a very nice match for the king of France. But, okay, so they're not just cousins. This is a little disturbing to modern listeners probably, they're double cousins. So they're the product of a French brother and sister married to a Spanish brother and sister. And actually one of the families is the Habsburgs too, and they're notoriously inbred already. So it's amazing that this line continues. It's actually a successful match. But it doesn't seem like this marriage is necessarily going to happen for a while. And that's because Spain and France are just constantly at war with each other. But guess what? Finally, they work out a peace in the Peace of the Pyrenees in 1659. And a major part of the deal is going to be cementing the alliance with this marriage between cousins.
Yes. And Louis had actually already found his first great love, but he was prepared to do his part and to marry Maria Theresa. And similarly, she's ready to do her part for God and country and family as well.
Yeah, and she's had this rather sad childhood too, as so many of these royal kids do. She loses her mother really early. So I think she's looking forward to having a new maternal figure in Anne of Austria, her aunt, who has really taken her on as a protege almost her entire life.
After the engagement was arranged, Louis wrote to Maria Theresa, "It was not without constraint that I yielded up till now to the arguments which prevented me from expressing to your majesty the sentiments of my heart." And then he continued, "I am delighted to begin to reassure her majesty by these lines that happiness could not arrive at anyone who more passionately wishes for it, nor anyone feel themselves happier in possessing it."
So that's a nice, sweet letter. It's in very formal terms, but Philip IV thinks it's a little too much for his daughter to even be receiving, won't let her read the letter. Finally, the proxy marriage goes through, which I've always thought is such a strange custom, but I guess you don't want to send your unmarried virgin daughter off across Europe alone, unless she's this legally wedded woman. But they have this proxy marriage in Spain. It's near the border. It takes place on June 3rd, 1660. And of course, Louis isn't there. That's why it's a proxy marriage. There's this Spanish dignitary. So I just can't imagine how strange it would be to go up there, have all the vows read and recited, and there's this stranger standing next to you.
Yes, this proxy ceremony was definitely not a precursor of the modern wedding. And what made it even stranger for the French is that Maria Theresa was decidedly Spanish.
Yes. I mean, think of those wide skirts you might recognize in Velázquez paintings, because, of course, Velázquez is the court painter at the time. She also has these piles of false hair, this sort of bouffant-styled hairdo.
Kind of like a 1660 snooky, almost.
I guess so. All these jewels. I think the French people in attendance were kind of shocked, maybe a little disappointed, disapproving of this future queen of theirs. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Not much. So now she becomes Marie Therese, and she's ready for Louis.
Yeah, so France's royal party has been on the way. It takes a while to get to Spain in these days. And the wedding is planned for June 9th near Bordeaux. Queen Anne is so excited. This is her lifelong, or not her lifelong, but as long as her son's been around, this has been her dream for him. And she's really sweet, too. She even writes to Marie back when the engagement is set up, that addressing her as her daughter and her niece. So she's definitely looking forward to bringing this new daughter into her life.
And this is a wedding at its best. It's essentially a family reunion, too, which is what weddings really are today.
Yeah, definitely. So the couple catch their first glimpse of each other when the brother and sister, Philip and Anne, are finally reunited after 44 years, which is unbelievable. I can't imagine going.
Well, you're an only child.
I am an only child, so I guess I really can't imagine.
She really can't.
But I mean, it's just a strange, I mean, they're in contact with each other during that mm-hmm. time, but how strange to be at war with your own brother's country.
Right, with your sibling.
They have a very restrained meeting, these two siblings, after so long. They don't hug each other, but they both apparently had tears in their eye. But meanwhile, the young people are trying to figure out how to catch a little glimpse of each other.
What am I getting into? What does he look like? What does she look like?
Exactly. Louis is given permission to ride near the window of the chamber where this meeting is happening and where Maria is. And instead of being discreet and riding by kind of far away, just getting his little peek at her. He wants to come disguised to the door and actually meet her. He's not allowed to do this. Marie is not allowed to acknowledge his salute, but they do get to catch this glimpse of each other, and he pronounces that she'll be easy to love, and she admits that he is certainly very handsome, which Louis had a major reputation for being a handsome guy in his youth.
So despite his dashing good looks, when she has to leave Spain, she's very tearful. This is goodbye to home, and she knows that her new life is about to begin. And this is a very grave matter for someone of her age.
Yeah, definitely. So the real marriage happens just a couple days later, June 9th, and it takes place in this 13th century church. And I think this is such an interesting detail, but it's such a big deal that the wedding happens here that the door the couple passes through is blocked up after the ceremony. It's still blocked up today, so if you wanted to go through it, too bad.
You could not walk down that aisle.
No. And she, I guess her style gets a little more French in the days between the proxy marriage and this marriage. She wears a gown covered in fleur-de-lis, and her hair, she doesn't have all this fake, snooky hair on anymore. She has her nice, thick, blonde hair. It's actually so thick that they can't really attach the crown to it very well. And her train is carried by two princesses, and she cuts as much of a figure as she can, I guess. She's very pale. She has these bright blue eyes. She has a Habsburg lip, which we would not really regard as a very beautiful feature nowadays, but at the time,
status symbol.
Yeah, it meant you were
royalty. You were inbred royalty. Good job.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, Louis is in black velvet and jewels, and immediately after the ceremonial dinner, he escorts her to the boudoir.
Yeah, and Anne closes the curtains on them, which I think would be a little awkward. I guess it's good they didn't stick around. That happens with some of the royal couples we've discussed before. The parents actually hang around, so this is a plus.
Again, not a tradition that is carried over into modern weddings,
not
thankfully.
At all. And this is interesting. Supposedly, Marie-Thérèse uses the opportunity of their first night together to make Louis promise that he'll always spend the night with her, or at least he'll come to bed with her eventually. And, I mean, over the course of their marriage, there's some pretty late nights where he's out and about, but he really does always come back to her bed and then gets up and goes to his own room in the morning. She sleeps in, as many of the Spanish royals did. I just think that's kind of a sweet gesture.
It is. Well, and considering that he was her only family in her
exactly.
new home, it was important to her to have that continuity. So at least in bed, the relationship, the marriage, it's a good one. But from a practical point of view, whereas you may enjoy reading the newspaper with your spouse or going to the park or antiquing, they don't have anything to do together.
No, and one of the major problems there is she has not been taught French, or at least very good French, which seems like a very big oversight for somebody who might grow up to be the French queen.
That's an integral part of a good marriage, speaking the same language.
I think it would
literally.
Help. I think it would definitely help. And she doesn't even really make a big effort to learn French. She sticks to all of her Spanish women and her dwarves and hangs out with her dogs, and she loves gambling and not all of the more intellectual pursuits that Louis is so fond of. She's not into dancing. She's really shy. You know, they really don't have much in common with each other. I do think it's interesting to learn a little bit about her, though, because we think so much of Louis in relation to all of his famous mistresses. And we think about his later marriage, which actually Katie and I did a podcast on Madame de Maintenon about a year ago. But I feel like his wife never really gets any play here.
Well, she certainly had her play today, and we will conclude her life story and the tale of their marriage by saying that she died after a very sudden illness at just age 45. And according to our records, one of the things that she said before leaving this world was, "Since I have been queen, I have had only one happy day."
We don't know what day that was.
Probably a dwarf day. A dog day.
Not the wedding day.
Not the wedding day.
And this is maybe even more tragic. After her death, Louis said, "This is the first trouble she has ever given me." Which, that's heartbreaking.
It is. And on that note from Louis, let's flash forward to another very eligible bachelor of his time, and that is the dashingly handsome JFK Jr. And everyone in the United States who was around at the time of John Kennedy's death remembers little John flashing his salute and being just the cutest child in the whole country. And as he got older, he became very handsome, very rugged, very outdoorsy, very athletic, and incredibly desirable. He was deemed the nation's most eligible bachelor. And he was 35 when he met the 29-year-old Carolyn Bessette.
Yeah, and they dated for about 2 years. And the way they met is very modern and hip, I guess.
It is. And people talk about Carolyn as being like the more modern version of a Jackie. She had the class. She had the posture. She had
clothes.
The carriage. She had the clothes. But she put a more contemporary spin on the things that she did. She was a publicist at Calvin Klein, and one of the things that she did for Calvin Klein was help celebrities pick clothes. And of course, JFK Jr. was quite a celebrity, so when he came in shopping for some suits, she was hooked up with him. And I would like to say that the rest was history, but it was a little complicated because they were never formally linked in the public eye. There were rumors abounding that he was still dating Daryl Hannah. And Carolyn, of course, being the sassy blonde she was a commodity in her own right. And at this time, JFK Jr. was the owner and co-editor of the political magazine George. So very much on the New York social scene, very much a hot item. So who would have thought that this couple could have escaped to an island in the United States, gotten married, and no one knew about it?
Yeah, suddenly they're married. It's unbelievable that they managed to get away with it.
It was the ultimate secret wedding. And I have to brag a little bit because where they chose to wed, Cumberland Island, which is a barrier island in Georgia, it's just 18 miles by 3 miles. This is actually just off the peninsula where I grew up in St. Mary's, Georgia.
And it's near where my grandfather grew up. So
we both have claims to fame to Cumberland.
Yeah.
And if you've never made it to Cumberland, you simply must go. It's gorgeous. There are fantastic ruins of great homes that were owned by the
Dungeness.
Yes, they were owned by the Carnegies back in the day, and there is still an inn, a fantastically expensive and luxurious inn, Greyfield, where you can stay, and wild horses roam the beach.
Beautiful, untouched beaches. And there's no bridge either, so if you get there, you have to take a ferry.
Yes. So Carolyn and JFK Jr. fly into the St. Mary's Airport, and some women come out from the county courthouse to issue their marriage licenses, and they file for them separately. And like I said, there's been no formal engagement announcement, no formal wedding announcement. No one knows that this is happening.
Not even the people involved in arranging the wedding, right?
Well, there are a few people who have an idea as to what's going on, and that would include Go-Go Ferguson, whose family had lived on the island for 6 generations. She helped plan the wedding, and she designed their wedding bands. And then the White House Rose Garden designer, Rachel Bunny Mellon, was in the know. And the man who had been Jackie's lifelong butler did the altar greenery. But other people who were more, shall we say,
the talent at the wedding.
Thank you. The talent at the wedding. Like, for instance, the Yulee, Florida man who came in to sing gospel a cappella. He had no idea that he'd be singing for JFK Jr. and Carolyn Bessette. And he describes how before the ceremony began, they pulled him aside and said, "We'd really like for you to sing Amazing Grace." And he's sort of wide-eyed at this point. I can't believe this is happening. And if you look at the one picture that's so popular in the media of this wedding, it's of John and Carolyn descending the steps of this 1893 cabin. It's essentially a cabin. It's the first African Baptist church on the island. There was no electricity, so the whole ceremony was illuminated by candlelight. And he's in a suit and his father's watch. And she's in this gorgeous pearl white silk crepe gown by Narcissa Rodriguez. And she's got silk gloves and a rolled silk tulle veil and a hair clip that had belonged to Jackie. Oh, and he's kissing her hand. It's just gorgeous. It's modern royalty.
Well, and her gown kind of kicked off a look for that style, I'd say.
It did. It's that zipperless, over-the-head sheath.
It's the opposite of the princess look.
Exactly. It's that form-fitting style, and it's the kind of style that earned her this description in W Magazine when they called Carolyn a cool blonde with something sexy, even raunchy, about her.
I like the little voice and emphasis you put on that
one. Even raunchy about her. But what was sweet about the wedding is that according to at least one report, when she came down from the church steps, she was carrying a bouquet of lily of the valley, and supposedly one of the wild horses of Cumberland came out and nibbled from it. And I think that might be sensational.
They're really shy.
They are shy. And I had a friend once who went with me to the island when I was in college, and there are no porta potties on Cumberland once you hit the beach. And she was relieving herself behind a sand dune and a horse snuck up on her. But that is the closest I have ever heard of a horse coming to a human.
I went on a class trip in about fourth grade, so it wouldn't have been too long before this wedding, actually. And the horses came up near our campsite, but as soon as they saw us, they were out of there, not nibbling on any bouquets.
Well, maybe they knew that it was Carolyn Bessette Kennedy's bouquet. Well, anyway, so all of that aside, horse stories, etc., they had a very nice reception at the Greyfield Inn. It was perfectly intimate and private, only about 40 guests. And you may be thinking, 40 people? That's not even the whole Kennedy clan. Well, no, it wasn't. They had to leave some people out to ensure their privacy. And after the wedding occurred, it wasn't until Sunday afternoon, I believe, that the press kind of got a hint of what had happened. And by the time they descended on Cumberland, the couple was gone for their honeymoon in Turkey. And one of the earliest confirmations of the marriage came from Caroline Kennedy Schlossberg, who flashed a thumbs up sign at a reporter who took her picture.
Pretty discreet.
Pretty
family,
discreet.
I guess. This, unfortunately, it sounds like a lovely wedding, but it unfortunately culminated in a very tumultuous marriage.
And some would say this is all part of the Kennedy curse, but the marriage did not work out as far as we can tell. And they were married for just a few short years before their sad deaths. But he wanted kids. She wasn't sure she wanted kids. They both accused each other of having affairs. They lived apart. Carolyn did not enjoy being scrutinized by the public. There are reports that she was depressed and continued to use cocaine. And her sister, Lauren, urged the two of them to reconcile and attend Rory Kennedy's wedding together in Martha's Vineyard. And this was in the summer of 1999. John agreed to fly all three of them in his single-engine plane. And as you may remember, it crashed in the ocean on July 16th, and Navy divers later recovered their bodies.
So another tragic wedding on our list.
But we have the beautiful picture, and I'm sure that that is how the couple would want to be remembered.
So from one cool blonde to another, the next lady on our list is the beautiful Grace Kelly and her marriage to the Prince of Monaco. So Grace Kelly is definitely known for living up to her name. You know, she's stylish. She's beautiful. She was described by Alfred Hitchcock as a snow-covered volcano, just because when you look at her on screen, she looks so poised and collected, but there's so much emotion underneath. She seems like she could just erupt at any moment. And I think from what I read about her, that's kind of how she was in person. She was a very fiery woman who sort of kept it all in a neat package.
And what was interesting about Grace Kelly is that she knew what she wanted in life, but her family didn't expect that much from her.
No, they really didn't. She was the third child of four of a very prominent Philadelphia family. She has these amazing athlete parents. Her father was an Olympian. Her mother was the first woman to teach phys ed at Penn. She didn't really live up to the family standards. She was really shy. She wasn't athletic. She was kind of sickly. She had asthma when she was a kid. But she was really serene, and she was also really full of imagination. At one point, she told her older sister, "One day I'm going to be a princess," which probably most little girls say that.
I'm
but
sure.
In this story, it seems like
she
a very telling
practice.
Line. And she gets into acting because of all that imagination. It's not something her family initially approves of, but she proves very good at it.
And she had to train herself to speak in a lower tone and less nasally. But I suppose when you're from a family of athletes and you can't play the field, you have to play on the stage. And she was determined to make that work.
Yeah, she wasn't really well suited for the stage, though, partly because of that voice. She just didn't have much power behind it. But on camera, she was absolutely stunning. And once she got going on this film career, it was this amazing burst of success and great films. She won an Academy Award. It's weird, though. It's not like she started with a few little parts and worked up from there. Most of her success comes from this one screen test from 1950, which she didn't even get the part she was auditioning for.
But it got shown around Hollywood, and she became an overnight success.
Yeah,
she really did.
John Ford saw it. Alfred Hitchcock saw it. They cast her, and she just went from there. She's also pretty well known in her Hollywood days for working out a really sweet studio deal. Studios at the time would basically make their stars sign their lives away. But she worked out a nice deal where she could be a little more flexible with the projects she chose, and it paid off. In 1955, she won an Oscar. She had 4 films in theaters, and she made more money than any other female star. So this is the pinnacle of her career. It looks like she's just going to keep on going and have decades ahead of her of great success. And then suddenly
she decides that despite dating around and hooking up with some very eligible bachelors, she wants to get married.
Yeah, according to her friend and biographer Gwen Robbins, she didn't want to have to age in Hollywood, which I can kind of understand that, especially at this time. There just may have not been very many parts in another decade or two. But she meets her prince at the 1955 Cannes Film Festival, and this is, of course, Rainier Grimaldi, and he's the Prince of Monaco, which is a French principality.
And it's tiny.
It's a postage stamp.
It's a postage stamp. Sarah, I think that you mentioned it was smaller than Central Park.
Smaller than Central Park. But very beautiful, very picturesque. It looks like old Europe.
And so she sees that he's got an offer she can't refuse. And not only that, she has an offer that he can't refuse because his former girlfriend, also an actress, was barren. So he needs to ensure that he can create an heir. Otherwise, Monaco gets handed over
back
to France.
Yeah.
So despite Grace Kelly having all the features that he desires, he still demands that when they get married, she hand over a $2 million dowry.
Which, that's from life. I can't get over that number. I mean, her family was very well off.
And
she earned a lot of money herself.
She did.
But that is so much money in the 1950s. One of her last films is kind of interesting considering her future. It was called The Swan. And in it, she played a princess. So while Rainier was courting her, she was actually playing the part of a princess.
The dress rehearsal, if you will.
Exactly. And in the plot of the film, she's torn between her younger love and the prince who she's intended to marry. She ends up choosing the prince. It all works out for her story in the end. I can't imagine if the movie had been a little different, it might have not fit very well.
And that film wrapped in December 1955, and that marked their official engagement on December 28th. So just a few days after Christmas, she gets the best present ever, a 12-carat emerald-cut diamond flanked by 2 baguettes.
She probably had to buy it herself.
Considering that
dowry. You better get a good ring.
And what's funny about all of these different subplots adding up into this one big arc of her storyline is that she was engaged at the time to fashion designer Oleg Cassini.
So Grace gets married in what is called the wedding of the century. We're going to have another one of those on this list in a minute.
Hold your royal horses.
Yeah, but she calls it the carnival of the century, and it's easy to understand why. She arrives in Monaco on a ship with an entourage of 66 people. And the law and tradition of the country has that a civil ceremony comes before the religious ceremony. So that first event takes place on April 18th, 1956, and it's in the throne room of the palace, and it's presided by a high court official, and she wears this very sharp beige lace dress and hat. It looks like something she'd wear in a movie almost. And then they appear, they wave on the balcony to the crowd. And then the big ceremony, the religious one, happens the next day. And that's the one that you'd probably recognize pictures from.
Right. And at the ceremony, there were two 1,000 reporters. That's more reporters than there were guests. But the guest list did have some very important people on it, some VIPs for that day and age. Cary Grant, Gloria Swanson, Ava Gardner, Conrad Hilton, Aristotle Onassis. But not in attendance, notably, it was Queen Elizabeth II. It was a little too déclassé for
royalty. She supposedly thought there were just too many movie stars.
Too many movie stars. That's never held me back from attending any event.
But this, I mean, with all this press, with all these stars there, this is sort of the first major press event that we, you know, like we could think of later weddings.
Well, I mean, the wedding was filmed by MGM.
Yeah, it's this big to-do. It's filmed by MGM. It's broadcast live to 30 million people in Europe. And bars even make up the signature cocktail called the Princess Cocktail with bourbon and grenadine and fresh cream. Does not sound very good to me.
Yeah. It sounds cool and icy like Grace Kelly, though.
So at this grand cathedral ceremony, Grace wore an ivory gown made of silk taffeta and lace, and it was designed by the famous Hollywood costumer Helen Rose. It took 6 weeks and 36 seamstresses to make. It required 25 yards of silk taffeta, 100 yards of silk net, 125-year-old rose point lace from a museum. I mean, I just bought some Halloween costume fabric this weekend. 2 yards? I'm trying to imagine buying 100 yards of fabric
dress. Before Grace Kelly, no one really did the big poofy ball gowns for a wedding. This was unheard of. And today, that style is sort of alternately called ball gown or princess style. And when you hear it referred to princess style, that's based off Grace Kelly's wedding.
How about that?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, TLC Candace.
I tip my hat to you.
So the couple... It's not a particularly intimate wedding, surprise, with all these people here. The couple stayed directed at the high altar, and Kelly was visibly nervous during the whole thing. She just was kind of whispering, if you can actually look up videos of it, and she looks like eyes on the prize, not looking anywhere else, like she's afraid she'll fall over or something. But at the end, this message from the Pope was read out loud, and then the couple drove off through Monte Carlo in a convertible and left their honeymoon, which was a multi-week cruise aboard a yacht.
And on their honeymoon, she became pregnant with Caroline, and she later popularized the Hermes bag, the Kelly, because she would use this really oversized purse to hide her, what we today would call her baby bump.
That would, in a tabloid today, there'd be a little arrow.
A little arrow.
With a question mark.
Is she? Isn't she?
Yeah.
But despite the joys of carrying a child and giving birth to a child, married life was a little sour for Grace Kelly.
Yeah. She'd hoped that maybe she'd still be able to work a little bit, go to Hollywood every now and then and make a movie. Her husband was not into that idea. In fact, supposedly he banned her films from even showing in Monaco. And she later told her friend John Foreman, "I know where I'm going to be every single day for the rest of my life." And that was not said in like a happy way. "I'm going to be in Monaco where it's sunny and beautiful." Again, Monaco, smaller than Central Park. So we can imagine kind of a restrictive, if glamorous, life. And she died tragically in a car crash in 1982.
And that untimely segue brings us to the last wedding on our list. And by now, you may have guessed what it is. One of the biggest wedding spectacles of our time. And that would be the wedding of Diana and Charles. So Charles and Di knew each other when they were children, and they weren't exactly close in age when they got married. She was 20 and he was 32, but they had associated, their families had, so they were not unfamiliar with each other. And when he proposed with a giant oval sapphire surrounded by 14 diamonds, thank you very much, she was a teacher. So she's coming from not a modest exactly background, but something that is not quite in the public eye to something that is incredibly on the forefront of British society.
Definitely.
And on her wedding day, again, like Sarah was saying, you can see footage of Grace Kelly's wedding online. You can also see plenty of footage of Charles and Di's wedding, and she wore one of the most famous wedding gowns of all time. It was an ivory silk gown designed by David and Elizabeth Emanuel. It had lace accents and big puffy sleeves, hello 1980s, gathered with little ribbons. And unfortunately, the designers didn't accommodate for the fact that she would be transported to the wedding site in a glass carriage. So when she got out, she was a little wrinkled.
It must have been hot and uncomfortable in the carriage,
and not to mention that 25-foot train taking up that much space, and the dress was made in just 4 months. And these people who designed the gown, the Emanuels, they were the same designers who put together the dress that she wore when Charles and Di announced their formal engagement. And this was sort of the start of maybe a couple of people in British society raising an eyebrow at Diana, because the dress was very highly criticized. People said it was too low cut and it was black. And at the time, black didn't necessarily mean that you were chic and meant that you were in mourning.
I think Diana later proved black was one of the best colors on her, though.
Definitely. So this wedding was televised in 58 countries. It was an hour and a half long ceremony that had 3,500 in attendance and 750 million watching on TV. And I believe I neglected to say the date, so let me correct that right now. July 29th, 1981. And not only is this a national holiday in Britain, but it's a total moneymaker. There's so much memorabilia going around, displaying the new royal couple, porcelain plates and cups and stamps and photo collages. And in one story I read, there was a woman who had bid $700 for a slice of cake from the wedding.
Yeah, and of course, Di was attended by a lot of bridesmaids, too, and most of them had royal connections, but not all of them.
There was one little girl named Sarah Jane, who was the daughter of Charles' friend and longtime horse trainer, and she actually kept up a correspondence with Diana after the wedding, and basically explained to Diana that she was miserable at boarding school, and Di had done her time at boarding school too, so she commiserated and had a sweet letter writing campaign with her.
Yeah.
But if you believe in fate or telltale signs, there were a couple of gaffes during the ceremony that perhaps predicted the marriage would not be a fairy tale one.
Yeah, she got Charles's names out of order.
She did.
He has a lot, of course.
Yes, and the name that she essentially called him was his father's name. And then he forgot to kiss her at the altar. They later did a public kiss on the balcony at Buckingham Palace, but that was a gaffe for sure.
Definitely. But after those gaffes, after the ceremony is complete and they make their appearance to the public, they go on their honeymoon at the family estate in Broadlands, and then they go on a 12-day Mediterranean cruise, much like Grace Kelly again. Kind of an abbreviated Mediterranean cruise, but still. And Diana's brother, who was only about 16 at the time of the wedding, later revealed that she had a terrible headache for the entire thing because she had this tiara pinching her temples and head.
Yeah, she wasn't used to wearing a tiara, obviously. And even though it came from the Spencer family, it was one of their heirlooms.
Yeah.
We know from Di's later works in her life, she was probably more comfortable in the garb of a humanitarian worker than wearing her tiara, although she did cut a fabulous figure in an evening gown as well. She wore so many hats, not to make a pun there, but she did. And then the marriage again, this is another one that ends on a sad note. It did not work out. And you all probably know why. Charles supposedly had kept up his romantic dalliances with Camilla Parker Bowles, to whom he is now married. So the couple separated in the late 1980s and formally announced their split in 1992. And then on August 31st, 1997, Diana was killed in a car crash.
Yeah, and Charles got a little credit after that for insisting that she be given a royal funeral, even though that wasn't the protocol since they were a divorced couple.
And that also was televised on TV, and the world watched on, very sadly, to see the princess gone way too early.
But it kind of brings us to our close here. There's another possible royal wedding on the horizon. At least all the gossip mags keep on covering it, trying to guess when it is. And that is, of course, between Charles and Diana's eldest son, William, and his longtime girlfriend,
Kate Middleton.
So we'll see if we have another royal wedding to add to this list. Hopefully, if it does take place, it'll be a much happier marriage than some of these.
And a less wrinkled wedding gown.
Definitely. All right. Well, I guess that about wraps it up. Do you have anything else you want to add?
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's been fun, Candace. If you want to email us or suggest any other favorite royal wedding stories, you can find us on Twitter at Missed in History. We're on Facebook, and we also, of course, have an old-fashioned email address. It's historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. And if you want to look for any of Candace's great wedding content, you can find it at TLC. And if you want to learn a little more about royalty, go to the homepage and search for royalty at www.howstuffworks.com.
The HowStuffWorks.com iPhone app is coming soon. Get access to our content in a new way. Articles, videos, and more, all on the go. Check out the latest podcasts and blog posts and see what we're saying on Facebook and Twitter. Coming soon to iTunes.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.